I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. And I'm going to start out with an announcement, so some of you may not be waiting, or you can wait if you like, but we are going to carry over House Bill 2826, 2536, 2955. And I think that's it, Bob. And House Bill 3389. Right. Oh, those are ones we were supposed to have. So, Christy is available to give them to us. Thank you. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3116. Bob, give us a description of House Bill 3116.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3116 eliminates the exemption from the public contracting code for the Oregon University System, requires contracting agencies to post cost analyses, findings, and determinations relating to procurements for services exceeding $250,000 onto the Oregon Transparency website. Substantive provisions are operative January 1st, 2014, and the measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I'd like to call up Jackson Dolly and Stacy Cowan.
Hi there.
Good evening. Welcome.
Good evening.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Chair Holview, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Cowan. I'm with SEIU. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3116. I'll keep my comments brief and allow Mr. Staley to speak on behalf of SEIU's position on the bill. I just wanted to help set the context a little bit. House Bill 3116 ends the university system's current exemption from the public contracting code, and our specific interest is in ORS 279B, which has to do with personal services and goods. Some might ask why we would consider legislation bringing the OUS into a state system as the legislature's considering granting more autonomy to the university system. And for us, the answer is pretty simple. The university system is expecting to receive nearly $750 million in taxpayer money this biennium. Obviously, that's not an insignificant amount of money. More importantly, though, 60% of funding for higher education is paid out of the pockets of Oregon students and their families. So in light of this, and in light of the recent Secretary of State audit calling into question the level of transparency and financial reporting and some other issues at the university system, we actually think that a conversation about increasing the level of transparency and accountability at the university system is actually extremely relevant. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Staley.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jackson Staley. I work for Western Oregon University's Hammersley Library as an electronic resource and serials technician. I am also a member of SEIU 503, and I am president of my campus local WU082. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3116. Currently, information on Oregon University's system contracts is not readily available. In fact, it is quite difficult to gather, and with the exception of capital construction contracts, OUS makes no information available on the Oregon Transparency website. House Bill 3116 removes the Oregon University System's exemption from the existing contracting code. Passing the bill will increase transparency and ensure that OUS is held to the same high standards applied to other entities spending taxpayer money. Highlighting this problem, a recent audit by the Secretary of State found that the OUS's current financial reporting is not effective for evaluation and cost management. For example, in our own research over the last year, we ran into many challenges even gaining access to how Oregon universities spend public dollars. It took quite a bit of time and money to get just a partial list of the contracts, but here are a few examples of what we found for just fiscal year 2012. Oregon State University spent over $25 million in taxpayer money contracting out maintenance and IT in just 2012. Portland State University spent $1.5 million of taxpayers' money on miscellaneous personal service contracts. PSU does not provide any additional information as to what these miscellaneous personal contracts might entail. In 2009, Oregon passed legislation to increase the accountability of taxpayer money. A key piece of this legislation required public employers to complete a feasibility study before contracting out services over $250,000. If this study shows it is less expensive to use in-house personnel, the work will not be contracted out. This just makes sense. What doesn't make sense is to continue to exempt Oregon universities, allowing them to spend millions with very little accountability, while our students bear more and more of the cost of public education than ever before. As other committees in this building are debating the issues of greater autonomy for Oregon universities, it is essential to require a high level of transparency whenever dollars are being spent. It is even more essential as the legislature considers bills that lessen state oversight over Oregon universities and how they spend tax dollars. At a time when Oregon students and their families are paying more and accumulating ever-increasing debt, we have an obligation to guarantee that they know how their hard-earned dollars are being spent. Extending the contracting out provision of 3116 to OUS helps us spend wisely. As such, I urge you to support House Bill 3116. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So what this bill does is for any procurement of services over $250,000, it lists those services on the Oregon Transparency website, period.
I'll go ahead and take that. So what it would do is it would bring the university system into, I'm sorry, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan with SEIU, it would bring the university system under the requirement to complete the feasibility studies for contracts over $250,000. Another piece of the provision that's not currently a part of 279B would be requiring those feasibility studies to be posted to the transparency website.
Follow-up question.
Follow-up.
For those of us who don't know, tell us, what does a feasibility study entail?
Sure. Currently right now, contracting agencies that complete feasibility studies, the forms vary. It's not one particular form that they're required to complete. There is a level of questions or a variety of questions that they're required to ask. So what type of work is being contracted out? What's the reason for contracting out? For example, agencies may not they may have a position vacant. There may be a time sensitivity, that type of thing. So they have to sort of explain what they're contracting out. To do a cost analysis, to do an estimate of what the cost would be to keep the work in-house and then what that cost would be to contract out the work. Most of the feasibility studies I've seen usually entail about 2 pages. Usually it's a few checked boxes and then there's some math that compares the costs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just curious, is there a sample form online somewhere?
There isn't. We have, again, I know the ones that I've seen, they vary a little bit, but I'd be happy to get a couple of copies so you can get a sense of what they look like, so I can provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It appears that here is an example.
It isn't that quick.
It's good.
We can hand this to the committee. And again, I'd be happy to get you additional examples. They do vary a little bit from agency to agency or local government, so I can get you a sampling of what those look like.
Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, OUS has had its, let's say, freedom or autonomy regarding separation from the public contracting system since about, I think, 1997, somewhere in the late 90s. And I wasn't here then, but I do believe the intent in giving them that freedom was to help them be able to operate more efficiently, recognizing that the public interest in helping them function as efficiently and cost-effectively as possible is directly related to tuition, related to student costs, and so forth. And I just wonder if you have considered the impact to the students with putting OUS back under the public contracting and the requisite, or probably the unintended, maybe it is, I don't know what your intents are here, but the likely result is going to be that their costs of administration, putting them back under DAS for administration and so forth regarding procurement, perhaps also under Department of, also DOJ regulations again and so forth, is in my mind almost certainly going to involve increased costs. And obviously there's no place to go for these universities to recoup those costs other than the tuition that students pay. So is your primary consideration here employee-based or student-based?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, absolutely the intention has to do with ensuring that the universities are spending the dollars that they have as efficiently as possible. We feel like there's been several examples over the years. The first one that comes to mind is the issue around student fees last year. So examples of the university system contracting out when maybe they shouldn't be, or contracting, spending more to contract out food service when maybe it would be less expensive to keep that work in-house. So I think what we'd like to do is to find, you know, striking that balance, ensuring that there's an increased level of transparency to ensure that they are spending their dollars as efficiently as possible.
Follow up. And obviously you're aware that the, you know, the State Board of Higher Ed oversees the actions of the university system and so forth. So I guess what you're saying then is that the State Board of Higher Ed has been negligent in their obligations and responsibilities to ensure that the universities are doing the best that they can possibly do to guarantee the most efficiency so they can keep tuition low. Is that, are you saying that the State Board of Higher Ed is negligent or derelict in their duties?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, what we're saying is that we think that there's absolutely some room for improvement here around transparency and accountability.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. As you referenced rightly that there are a number of reforms underway regarding higher ed governance and so forth, and one of those bills is Senate Bill 270. Mm-hmm. And the Dash 4 amendments in Senate Bill 270 and maybe even the previous amendments name the institutions that are part of the Oregon University system currently. Upon passage of the bill, however, if University of Oregon has their independent board, if PSU has their independent board, and likely soon to follow, Oregon State University will have their independent board, they're no longer a part of OUS. So the net effect of what you're advocating for here is going to fall upon the backs of the regional institutions that are left. If you're really going after the most bang on procurement, it's not at that level. And I can assure you that those campuses are already strapped financially, so any increased cost that you're leveraging upon them is really going to be harmful for those students, for those institutions. So I don't know whether you considered that in this bill or not, but you may be missing the mark.
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, we absolutely appreciate those comments. And I, you know, as we were drafting the bill, recognizing that the conversation around autonomy, it was kind of a moving target. So I would say that You know, our intention here, you know, naming the university system, recognizing that what that means is changing. What we would really like to see, we recognize, again, there's a lot of different conversations happening. We would just like to see that the conversation about transparency and accountability happens. So if it's happening at the, if 270 passes, that this conversation would continue as those independent boards are created. If for some reason that weren't to pass, then as a university system, that the conversation about transparency and accountability happens. So just sort of operationally how we move through session, it was a bit of a moving target. So this is sort of what we were left with for our bill. But again, it's about the broader context of if it is institutional boards or individual boards, that we would just like to see something like this modeled for those boards. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Other questions? So I have one. I'm not seeing any other committee members at this point. You had referenced the Secretary of State audit and, you know, its report that the financial reporting was not effective for evaluation or in cost management. And then you go on to mention that it took quite a bit of time and money to get a partial list of contracts. Now, I'm kind of curious about your experience with that, because I think they're subject to disclosure of public contracts, and you can get those for the, you know, I think a reasonable cost for printing them. So can you tell me what is your experience with trying to get those documents that are public documents from the university system?
Chair Holvey, we actually started working on that this summer. We were curious. We were looking at contracting. We were curious at what level the university system, what types of things they were contracting out for goods and services. So we actually did a public information request. And we cast our net pretty broad, and we actually went to, I believe, all of Oregon's university systems. I worked with one of our researchers. And the response that we got back was sort of one of those responses that makes you feel like you clearly were looking in the right direction, because what we got back was a variety of responses ranging from, yes, we'll get you that information. It's going to take approximately 6 to 7 months, and it will cost you about $4,000 or $5,000. And then we have some universities that actually told us that they didn't really keep track of the information we were asking, that it would be very difficult for them to pull together a list of the active contracts that they had. So in and of itself, that answer was troubling, that the lack of tracking the data was such that they weren't able to even offer us the information we were looking for. So we decided to narrow it down to three universities, the University of Oregon, Oregon State, and PSU. Again, we got some more pushback. The cost was fairly excessive, and it varied anywhere from, I think, several thousand dollars down to a couple of hundred dollars amongst those three universities. So then we decided to narrow down what contracts we were looking for. Instead of all personal services, personal goods and services, we decided to narrow it to IT and food service and janitorial. And then even within that data, it was really a mixed bag in what we received. And I don't want to misstate the figure, but I do believe we still had to pay several thousand dollars for the request. So recognizing that we were asking to pull together a good amount of data, so there was definitely time that was put into that, but it sort of just led us to feel like if we were having this much difficulty accessing the information, obviously the average person probably wasn't going to be as persistent nor necessarily have the resources if they were trying to find a large amount of information. So that's what led us to really want to see this information be available in a more public way. And then obviously the conversation around tracking became more relevant as well.
And so I have one final question for you. So it seems like a lot of your issues are around transparency, and then how does that relate to the public contracting code, as far as you wanting the university system to be under the public contracting code?
The biggest, Chair Holvey, the biggest interest that we were pursuing really has to do with the feasibility study. So that comparison, making sure that the university system was doing a cost analysis when they wanted to contract out work, ensuring that the work they were contracting out for, in fact, was less expensive than doing the work in-house. Same that we see with state agencies and local governments. That was the biggest piece of it. And then again, the transparency of it. So once that cost analysis was completed, is it available in a format that the public can access it?
Thank you. Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just tell me why they were left out of the 2009 legislation?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, I actually don't know the answer to that. I wasn't a part of the project that created the 2009 legislation, so I wouldn't be able to speak to that.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today, or this evening, and thank you very much.
You.
Up next, I have Drew Hagedorn, Ryan Hageman, and Hillary. Hillary. I'm not going to try the last name. I can't read it. Hillary B.
Bowden.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I am Drew Hagedorn. I'm here today appearing on behalf of the Oregon University System. I'm joined today by Hillary Vance, who's the Director of Contracting and Purchasing for OUS, and Ryan Hageman, who's OUS's General Counsel. I want to thank you for the opportunity today, and Mr. Chair, appreciate you putting us first at the agenda. It's probably the best thing that's happened to me all day. So I know we're all busy, and we'll try to be concise in our remarks. We're testifying today in opposition to this proposal. In hearing the proponent testimony, it strikes me that the issue that they're seeking to address is maybe on the transparency side and also on the issue of contracting out. And we believe that this bill probably doesn't remedy their objectives. It doesn't solve the problem they're seeking to address. What it does do is create a whole host of unintended or perhaps intended consequences that create real issues at our member institutions. So I'm going to turn now to Ms. Bounce, who's going to talk to you a little bit about our current procurement methods, both on the goods and services side, as well as for the procurement of public improvements. And you'll note in the section of the bill that deletes reference to OUS's exemption. That's at the top of page 3 in that first line. We believe that that deletion would also pull in public improvements into the bill so that we'd be subject to the code for public improvements, not just goods and services. So with that, I'll turn now to Ms. Bounds, and then Mr. Hageman will talk a little bit about the bill's ramifications for some of the reforms per Senate Bill 242 in 2011. So I'll pause now, and Hillary.
Hey, Chair Holvey, committee, I would just like to speak briefly on the systems, the processes and policies that we have in place for our system.
And
that all
you do need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh,
please.
I'm sorry. I'm Hillary Vance, the Director of Contracting and Purchasing for the Oregon University System. Thank you. Well, I want to start by briefly discussing the policies and procedures that we follow as all of our institutions under our own contracting code, and then I'll speak briefly about the unique processes that we have on the capital construction side that would be removed by the passage of this bill, and then briefly discuss some effects that it would have on our staffing and administrative costs if this bill would be passed. To begin, you know, we have OARs which lay out the groundwork for all of our purchasing and construction contracts and procurements. Each campus on top of that also has internal policies and procedures that they've worked with their internal stakeholders to identify their priorities and local community needs that they follow, which from the small campuses may be something to encourage local business, to the large campuses something that is more of a decentralized purchasing system like you see on our big campuses. We also use template documents that have been drafted throughout the last, since 1997, to reflect our unique status. Those are used both in goods and services and in construction and reflect our unique status and would all have to be rewritten and revised as part of this transition into the public contracting code if this bill passed. These template documents are used by all of the campus staff who have purchasing and contracting authority, and they have resulted in really increased efficiencies in our ability to serve a growing student population without having to invest the money into our contracts departments that, you know, we have been able to more leanly staff than would be in a similar institution otherwise. To speak specifically to our construction projects, which, as Drew mentioned, we feel that the as this bill is written, it would affect our capital construction spend and the way that we do contracting for public improvements. Specifically, a program that we run at the system is the retainer program, which is how we respond to emergent needs on student housing, research facilities, our campus, our labs, all of the unique structures and the great amount of square footage that the universities own that make us unique than the other public agencies. Our retainer program allows us to have a roster of about 350 to 400 construction firms, and also 350 to 450 professional consultants who work in construction-related industries like architects and engineers. They have all signed uniform contracts that indicate what their abilities are, what kind of insurance they can obtain to work on our campuses, and it allows an opportunity for them to negotiate a contract that is in place for 2 years. Our campuses all use the same contract, which really diminishes the burden on the front offices of these small businesses. Often they may only have one or two employees that do the work. This gives them an opportunity to minimize and streamline paperwork and the bureaucratic processes, but an opportunity to get on our campuses and do small projects that we believe ultimately lead to them growing capacity. This has been specifically helpful for our MWESB programs, which are unique to the university system, which we are able to utilize because of our separate status under the contracting code. Specifically, you know, of these 400, it's roughly about 700 to 800, depending on the year, of companies that are on these contracts. We accept somewhere between 95 and 98% of applicants into the program. So it's very easy. It's all been moved onto the internet. They can do hard version if they'd like, but we've gotten very positive feedback from moving it to the electronic application process. It's ongoing. We used to, in the hard version, hard documents, we could only do it every 2 years because of the staff time. Now we take applications consistently throughout the two-year period. So we are constantly adding firms to our program, and they're able to work with all the seven campuses. So anyone can get on. We have about 95 to 98% acceptance rate, and of all of those companies, 40% of those regularly are doing work on our campuses. Of those 40%, 25% are MWESB certified firms. So it's been a very successful vehicle for us to get new contractors onto our campuses, doing projects that they are appropriately insured and with their capacity, with the goal that they can add this to their resume and they can build their company and start competing with all public agencies based on the experience they've gained at the university system. When we look at these contracts under the retainer program, we are able to calculate that the average project is about $43,000 and the median project is $22,000. So you can see that they're on the small side. They're not typically up near the $1 million. But what that also does show is that it would be a huge impact if we had to start competing down to $5,000 and the amount of extra staff and administration it would take for us to cover that delta would be a huge impact and result in us having to add a lot of staff, both on the construction contracting side and the goods and services. We have not been asked to provide a financial impact statement at this time, but I did reach out to the campuses to speak with them about what they realistically thought might be our staffing needs, both for the transition period to move under the contracting code and also as a long-term ongoing annual expense. For the transition period, it was hard to get any firm feedback because I think it was hard for people to wrap their minds around unwinding, you know, nearly 20 years of one way of doing business, and most people haven't been at the campuses since before we were under the public contracting code. So what that would mean is every person on our campus would need training in order to learn how the new contracting code would work, and it would require us to centralize a lot of our purchasing that is now decentralized in order for different departments to be able to be flexible with their budgets and with their specific needs, you know, if it's a science lab versus, you know, the medical clinic or something like that. We allow them to sort of make their own internal budgeting decisions and have spend up to a low threshold of $25,000. In addition to that, I did get some estimates on what would be our ongoing annual expenses, and we have very different campuses. As you all know, our small campuses are very leanly staffed, typically a couple part-time staffs to do their purchasing and contracting, up to the large campuses who have up to 10 staff members to do their purchasing and contracting. Their estimates for moving under the public contracting code for the small campuses was typically 1 to 2 additional staff on an ongoing basis, FTE. And then for the large campuses, they estimated anywhere between 3 and 8 additional staff. And that would be an annual increase that would have to be ongoing and, if anything, just increasing. The U of O went back and looked at some of their contracts and were able to extrapolate out that it would probably double the amount of solicitations they do in order to go down and hold the solicitation processes down to $5,000. In addition, there would also be some stresses on our electronic and tech side that I wasn't able to speak to them on such short notice, but in order to run the electronic bidding opportunities down to $5,000, and that was something that was going to put additional stress on those staffs, and they estimated it would have to add some ongoing permanent staff in that department also.
So thank you, and I appreciate that you could probably give us another hour worth of testimony.
I probably could, sorry.
And I'd like to hear from the Legislative Council, because I need to wrap up this hearing.
We were near the end of my remarks, so thank you very much, Chair Holby.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Hageman, and I am the General Counsel of the Oregon University System. I would like to take the opportunity to add a few comments to those of my colleagues in order to amplify OUS's position on House Bill 3116. Before I do, I'd like to respond to a comment about the transparency website from Representative Kenny Geyer. In fact, in 2009, when House Bill 2500 passed, the Oregon University System was part of the transparency website. In 2011, when Senate Bill 242 proposed to remove the university system from state agency status, we were expressly put back into the transparency website. In fact, from 2009, when the first advisory committee was established for the transparency website, our controller has served on that, I believe, with Representative Thatcher. So I will double check about the difference between capital construction and goods and services, but I know that I've seen my own outside counsel legal invoices on the goods and services transparency website. For context, the Oregon University System's exemption from the contracting code, as Representative Johnson points out, dates back to the mid-1990s from Senate Bill 271. For those 2 decades, the Oregon University System and its institutions have developed a public procurement process to reflect the unique challenges universities face. Hillary walked you through some of those facets of the program that are vital to the day-to-day operations of a university system, including but not limited to a highly functional and successful retainer program. With residence halls, classrooms, performance venues, international programs, auxiliary enterprises, but most importantly, 100,000 students living and learning on our campuses, a public, transparent, relevant, and appropriate contract code are essential elements to meeting both our mission and how we respond to emergent issues. House Bill 3116 would dismantle nearly 20 years of progress in this regard. Perhaps more importantly, though, is the philosophical inconsistency and departure that House Bill 3116 represents. In 2011, after months of study, drafting, and deliberation, this legislature passed Senate Bill 242, a transformative and significant step in granting the state's public universities the flexibility necessary to function and thrive in a 21st century world and better meet the needs of our students. The undercurrent of Senate Bill 242 is the recognition that universities had to embrace a new way of doing business. And building on the procurement exemption granted in 1995, the 2011 legislature made additional policy decisions, including granting OUS and its public universities the authority to hire its own attorneys and develop its own risk management system. With these freedoms, we have spent tremendous resources and thousands of hours, many of those personally for me, implementing Senate Bill 242 to make the best use of scarce public resources and student tuition dollars for the benefit of our students. With the authority over our own legal services, for example, OUS is no longer subject to the state's legal sufficiency review process for contracts. Instead, reflecting on the fact that we've had procurement autonomy for nearly 20 years, that we are responsible for our own liabilities, and that we were responsible for our own risk management program, we have developed legal services, risk management, and contract and agreement protocols to make the most of the promise of Senate Bill 242. In 2011, you entrusted the university system system with substantial autonomy so that we might deploy it for the betterment of students and the efficiency of our institutions. House Bill 3116 is an about-face from that promise and would deprive Oregon's public universities of the tools that has developed to operate in the new world as we work to meet the needs of today's students. Because it is inconsistent with Senate Bill 242, because it is inconsistent with the notion that OUS and its institutions are responsible for managing risk, because it is inconsistent with our obligation and authority over legal services, including the exemption from the legal efficiency process, and because it would cost millions of dollars to roll back this well-developed and appropriate procurement program uniquely suited for the rhythms and the needs of the university and our students, we must respectfully reiterate our firm opposition to House Bill 3116.
Really appreciate your comments, and the public hearing ran over a little bit, and I will say that you raised some good points and some valid concerns, but I will also note that I've just spent more than a year on a public contracting work group, and there wasn't one meeting, and there was several that there weren't contractors complaining about the construction contracting practices of the university system as to it not being fair, it not being transparent. And so I just wanted to put that on the record because it's a fact, and that I've heard all these things from contractors across the state. I just wanted to, there's two sides to every story. I appreciate your testimony, though. It was enlightening to listen to the processes you go through, and I'm sure they're quite relevant. This bill's not going to move forward, but I do know that there are people out there, not just in the public sector, but in the private sector, that are concerned with the contracting practices and its fairness and its transparency. So with that, thank you, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3116. Work session on House Bill 3172. Bob, give us a very brief description of House Bill 3172.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3172 is a measure that relates to residential septic systems. The committee adopted a -3 amendment in our April 16th meeting. The measure, as amended, has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. There was somebody here earlier. Committee, we heard a description from this from the realtors and the Department of Environmental Quality on the -3 amendment, and so we just want to take a motion and move this bill on if possible.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3172 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3172 to the floor with it as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any. Samantha?
Where is she?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kittingeyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3172, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. Is there objections to putting this on the consent calendar?
You don't want to?
Seeing.
I don't have.
Oh, grumbling down there? Okay.
Oh, I just think it might cause some people to be concerned.
Would anybody like to volunteer to carry it?
Sure.
That's what you checked.
I just complained about putting on a consent calendar.
What's the septic system?
So you're going to force me to do it? Was that a yes down there?
I'll carry it.
Oh, thank you. Representative Thatcher will carry House Bill 3172.
You've got another one down here.
Call me a no.
You're going to be a no?
No, I mean, I'll be gladly carry the bill. If it'll expedite tonight.
Well, you'll get another chance.
Yeah, you'll get another chance.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 3172. Let's move on to House Bill, open a work session on House Bill 3415. Bob, give us a description of House Bill 3415.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3415 is the measure that requires a public body acting as a radio commentary by providing access to a radio tower to charge market rate for access. The committee adopted on April 16th a -1 amendment that specifies that a public body or private nonprofit emergency services organization need not be charged a market rate for access. The measure has no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal statement, Mr. Chair. Let me pull that up. Fiscal statement. Oh, that's not the right measure.
I'm just trying to get the right one.
There is no fiscal impact to the measure as amended, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lively, can we have a motion on
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Samantha.
Representative Daugherty.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Byard.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. Representative Smith.
Sure.
Let's go have Representative Smith carry the bill. Okay. That'll close the work session on House Bill 3415. Let's skip down to open a work session on House Bill 3169. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 3169.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3169 allows a contract agency to meet the green energy technology requirement using energy generated away from the site of a public building if the green energy technology meets certain qualifications. The committee has before it a proposed -4 amendment, and we have individuals from the Department of Energy here to speak to that amendment. Mr. Chair, we have a statement of no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued with the -4 amendment. The measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Department of Energy. If you could just briefly tell us what the -4 is supposed to do.
Good evening, Representative Paul, members of the committee. I'd be happy to be brief tonight. The -4 does three very simple things. It sets a point in time for establishing what new green energy technology is. And for solar, that would mean a system which is added after the date of the issuance of an original building permit. For geothermal, that would mean construction of new capacity, which has been completed on or after January 1st of 2013. And January 1st of 2013 is the effective date of Senate Bill 1533, which was passed in 2012. And the third thing that it does is it removes the requirement for contracting agencies to report quarterly to the Department of Energy. And by doing that, it would also allow the department the time and manner through rule that the contracting agency shall report to the department. And I think I need to put my name on the record. If I apologize. Robin Freeman, Department of Energy.
Great. Thank you. And just as a note, this bill came forward as a cleanup to Senate Bill 1533 to enable the department to manage the geothermal component of the requirement.
Correct.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, can I have a motion?
What's the date on the dashboard?
What's the date on the dashboard?
21-1.
That's okay, just go for it.
Mr. Chair, I move the dashboard amendment to House Bill 3169 be adopted.
Representative Lively moves the dashboard amendment to House Bill 3169 be adopted. Discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, objection? Seeing none, the dashboard is adopted.
And okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3169 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3169 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the motion? Commissioner Johnson.
Just a question, Mr. Chair, about why this bill is in this committee and not in Energy and Environment, where it could be considered in cooperation with many other measures that deal with the same issue.
Thank you. There's probably a really long answer to that I can... I actually asked the same question because I actually preferred it to be addressed by the other committee, but for some reason the other committee wanted to move on with other projects, and I had a history with this issue. And so...
This issue with the chair.
Excuse me? A history with this issue. So
understood.
So in fact, I had worked out adding geothermal to this with Senator Whitsitt in last session, trying to make it work. And so there was some complications with that bill, and so we're trying to fix that here.
Oh, I just wanted to mention for historical perspective that 1533 passed out of the House, only two no votes, and it passed out of the Senate with only two people who were excused, actually, and no votes. So I think it's just supposedly an improvement on the existing law.
Right. I think the department had some trouble implementing the bill from last session and making it work for the geothermal aspect of the bill. Which was of great interest in Lake and Klamath counties, I believe.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I must mention I wasn't one of the no votes. FYI.
Thank you. Jeez, I'm old. So, Samantha, help me out. Oh, do we have a motion on this?
Yes, we do.
I thought we did, yeah.
Yeah.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. So, objections to putting this cleanup bill on the consent calendar?
No.
So, let's put this one on the consent calendar. It's not on the consent. It's going to Ways and Means.
Ways and Means.
It's going to Ways and Means. So
we don't even need a carrier or anything. So with that, House Bill 3169 is passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3169. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2429.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2429 is the measure that requires public bodies to remove personal information from electronic devices before disposing of those devices. The committee will recall from our April 16th meeting adopting a -4 amendment, which amended the definition of personal information, clarified that secure removal provision applies to devices owned, leased, or otherwise under the control of the public body. We have statements of no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued for the amended measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And committee, the fiscal impact came back substantial. I've requested the referral to Ways and Means on this from the Speaker's office. That has been granted. The bill will go down to Ways and Means to look at that fiscal and will be trying to be dealt with. I know the Judicial Department had a substantial fiscal, and it may be my intent to have that part of the bill eliminated to take that fiscal away, the requirement on the Judicial Department, if that is what the Ways and Means people come back with. So with that, Representative Lively, can we have a motion?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2429 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2429 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by a recent reference.
That's right. Sorry.
Discussion? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just mention that I'll be a no vote on this. I don't want it to go to Ways and Means as a unanimous vote, indicating that maybe we just want it to have them look at it. I think that this adds additional burdens to public agencies, that the problem that is seeking to be solved, in my opinion, is not so large that it needs to have state law that affects all agencies. So I'll be no vote.
That's a good point. I appreciate that point of view. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, in light of the topic we were discussing earlier this evening about contracting out, I think it's important to get on the record that Representative Gelser, in her testimony in front of the committee, said that the agencies could save money by accomplishing this through contracting out with outside personnel. So I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments? Questions? Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2429 having received the votes, move to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2429. Open a work session on House Bill 3035.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3035 is the measure that adds school districts and community college districts to public entities participating in the Oregon Transparency website. The committee has before it a proposed -1 amendment that replaces the measure and would require the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission to develop a plan for adding certain information or links to certain information to the Oregon Transparency website. Requires the commission to develop a plan for regularly updating information on that website. Requires the commission to develop a long-term vision and plan for a website emphasizing ease of use, and requires the commission to report details of the plans to the Legislative Assembly on or before January 1 of 2015. The measure with that -1 amendment has no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued for the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And has anybody described the -1 amendment to us?
Aside from what I just read?
Yes.
I think I just stole the thunder of individuals who are here to speak to the -1 amendment, Mr. Chair. I apologize for getting ahead of
you. You want to add anything to that description? You thought it was good. Okay. Thank you. I knew they were waiting around for something. So do we have a motion?
Chair, Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3035, dated 4/11/2013.
Tim Lively moves we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3035, dated 4/11/2013. Discussion on the amendment. Seeing none, is there objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, -1 amendments are adopted to House Bill 3035. Lively.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3035 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3035 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the motion.
Can I ask a 101 question, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Thank you. And I guess this, as a Ways and Means guy, I guess I need help on this. No. The proposed one amendments, this is a gut and stuff. Is this a gut and stuff? Mm-hmm. All right, I just want to make sure. Mm. All right.
We don't
see these in Ways and Means very often. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we have adopted the amendment, and just got informed that we actually do not have the fiscal on this bill. So I'm going to ask Representative Lively to rescind his motion.
I will rescind my motion on House Bill 3035.
So Representative Lively has rescinded his motion on House Bill 3035 to pass it to the floor with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So I apologize for that committee. Got a little ahead of my calendar here. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3035. And I believe we will be carrying over House Bill 3035. Still no, okay. No.
You think my staff could...
Yeah, I'd like to open up... Do we have the paperwork on these two?
We can't see much. Okay.
Do we have the paperwork?
I know. I had to write them in a shape because I couldn't
find it. No, gosh, it's the same dirty thing.
I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3145. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 3145.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3145 requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to administer and enforce state building codes for all capital construction projects that receive or are reasonably expected to receive more than $1 million in state-supplied funding. The committee does not have amendments before it at this time. The measure has no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued for the purpose of referring the measure to the Committee on Rules. Although the measure retains its subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means as well, Mr. Chair.
So, thank you. And so, committee, that it's the intent to move this bill, it's the building code rule, building codes bill, onto the Rules Committee for consideration. I'm going to move it without recommendation. We haven't seen any amendments to it, so that will be the proposed
3145
motion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we move House Bill 3145 to the Committee on Rules without recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3145 to the floor without recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Rules. Discussion on the motion? Representative Thatcher.
It's going to sound odd, but I'm going to vote no, just because I think I would prefer some interim work being done with the parties involved rather than kicking it over there.
Thank you. I know that they've continued their conversations on this bill and are coming closer and closer, but who knows, it could end up in the interim as well. I can't speak to that. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question. When it talks about state-supplied funding, is that referring to in addition to loan programs within Business Oregon that the department may use?
I'll have the department, who's been waiting patiently to answer that question, come on up.
And I guess to be specific on that, when we have port authorities that are working with private entities to construct facilities and they use loan programs within Business Oregon.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. If you give me just a second, I wasn't prepared for the question. I don't think it covers that, but I want to be accurate. And the Chair did mention that the parties are still working on the bill, and I suspect that there'll be further work on definitions and trigger points and who's in and who's out. So,
why don't we do this in the interest of time, Mr. Chair? Why don't I get with Mark?
Sure.
And yeah. That way we don't address his concerns, because yeah. I know they're still in the middle of all these discussions, so he may not know what those amendments are going to look like, I'm sure, at this point.
Free copies.
Yeah. Well, does anybody else have a question they'd like to ask Mr. Long? Got several, but I think we'll wait.
We don't have time. But,
sure. We'll have another chance, or at least I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, we have a motion and two rules. Samantha.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
I'm going to vote aye.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
You're not a rule. Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3145 has received the required votes and is passed to the Committee on Rules. I close the work session on House Bill 3145. Open a work session on House Bill 3349. In committee, this... Go ahead, Bob. Give us a description.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3349 amends the definition of a state for purposes of calculating medical assistance paid by the Department of Human Services or Oregon Health Authority. We have no amendments on the measure. The measure, as introduced, has no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has been issued for the purpose of referring the measure to the Committee on Rules, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And committee, we're just hearing this or having this work session on this bill. I don't believe we've had a previous public hearing on this bill, and we're just moving it to rules for their consideration.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3349 to the floor without recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3349 to the floor without recommendation, with a subsequent referral to rules.
Can I ask a procedural question? It goes to the floor and then rules?
It's a technicality. It technically goes to the desk of the floor before it can be assigned to the committee. I know it's confusing. That's the way it's supposed to be.
I want to make sure I know what I'm voting on.
I haven't had a hearing yet.
There's no procedure, William.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to say it, I suppose. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3349, having received their votes, is moved to the Committee on Rules. Close the work session on House Bill 3349. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3447. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 3447.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3447 is a measure that requires a person conducting floral business operation to disclose the physical location of the principal place of business in advertising, prohibits the misrepresentation of the principal place of business in advertising or otherwise, and makes misrepresentation an unlawful trade practice. The committee adopted in the April 11th meeting, -1 amendments that replace the measure prohibiting a provider or vendor of floral or ornamental products or services from misrepresenting the location of their business, specifies prohibited misrepresentations in advertising or listing, specifies the prohibition does not apply to publishers or providers of advertising or listing media, and authorizes the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to assess a civil penalty for violation of the prohibition.
Committee, I know this bill has been of great discussion. It will be the intent. I'm going to have a motion to reconsider the -1 amendments, and then we are going to take a motion on the underlying bill to move it to the floor. Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the -1 amendments to House Bill 3447.
Representative Lively moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the -1 amendments to House Bill 3447. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion?
Can we stand at ease for a moment?
Certainly. The committee will stand at ease. I'll bring the committee back to order, and we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3447. We have a motion on the floor.
To suspend the rules.
To suspend the rules.
Right.
You want to rescind your motion?
Okay. Chair Holby, I wish to rescind my motion to suspend the rules.
Representative Lively moves to rescind his motion. He does rescind his motion to suspend the rules. And now I'll close the work session on House Bill 3447. So, what else do we have left to do? Mm-hmm. Do we have the paperwork to send this one on? I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3328. Bob, remind us of House Bill 3328, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3328 is a measure that creates an exception to the Department of Administrative Services' sole control of state telephone and telecommunication systems for agencies that demonstrate cost savings may be obtained through private vendor contracts. The committee heard this measure on March 19. The committee has no amendments before it at this time. The measure, as introduced, has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued for the purpose of referring the measure to the Committee on Rules. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. In committee, as you just heard Bob mention, we are intending to send this bill to Rules for further discussion. It was one of the IT bills from Representative Harker.
Right.
So is this going to be without recommendation?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3328 to the floor without recommendation and a subsequent referral to Rules.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3328 without recommendation to the floor and with the subsequent referral to the Committee on Rules. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, Samantha.
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3328, having received the votes, is referred to Committee on Rules. Close the work session on House Bill 3328. And if you just stand at ease for a couple of minutes, I want to make sure we accounted for all the bills we have here. Stand at ease.
He receives them, but he doesn't see it.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency back into order. Committee, we don't have the paperwork for a few of these bills, and a few of these bills need a couple more comments and discussions before, and we'll deal with them tomorrow. So we are carrying over House Bill 3389. And House Bill 3165, House Bill 3447, House Bill 2826, House Bill 2536, House Bill 2955, and House Bill 3035. Thank you for staying late. Appreciate it. And I'm impressed that everyone's here. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.